as Juneteenth, National Independence Day, the first new national holiday in decades.
That's right, and Arkansans are reacting to the news today. Our Desmond Nugent spoke with one prominent state lawmaker about Juneteenth and how it highlights the need to embrace the teaching of America's full history. Desmond.
State Senator Joyce Elliott says while it's been a long journey for Juneteenth to be recognized as a federal holiday, the conversation about teaching critical race theory is just as important. It's a historic day that State Senator Joyce Elliott couldn't be prouder, Juneteenth becoming a national holiday. And while it's a special day for Elliott because her mother was born on the same day, she can't help but remind the importance of teaching critical race theory.
You can't fix things until you understand how they got the way they are many times. And critical race theory tries to empower us with understanding what happened that you're here, where we're still divided.
Juneteenth commemorates the last enslaved African Americans who learned they were free on June 19, 1865. This ended slavery. As of Thursday, the legislation bars state agencies from teaching any, quote, divisive concepts during racial and cultural sensitivity trainings, a celebration one Little Rock education advocate says needs to continue to be taught.
Making sure that that history is being taught and known, not only the torturous part of our history, but as well as our innovative part of our history and then helping shape our country.
Representative Mark Lowry co-sponsored the bill that opposes critical race theory. He says he agrees black history should be taught in the classroom, just in a different way.
Sometimes pits those groups one against the other, labeling students as oppressors or being privileged versus those who are marginalized. And I just don't think that that kind of divisive instruction in the classroom is a positive marker.
Lowry says while he does acknowledge that there are racist events that have and are happening in our country, systematically, he does not believe that to be true. Back to you.
Okay, Desmond Nugent at the Capitol for us tonight. Desmond, thank you. To be clear, critical race theory is not being taught in Arkansas schools, but it has also not been banned.
Six tonight, a bill will go before a Senate committee next week that aims to promote racial healing by increasing education.
If signed into law, Senate Bill 674 would create a Black History Commission for the state and create a Remembrance Week for the 20th century's Elaine Massacre when white landowners killed more than 100 Black Arkansas sharecroppers for unionizing. Also, it would direct the State Board of Education to allow for an Arkansas Black Culture course.
This is just the beginning. Hopefully, we can continue doing things like this and we can start trying to make real change and bringing Arkansas together.
That if they care about Arkansas's future, if they care about Arkansas right now, we can't change the past, but we can certainly use the past as a tool to educate, empower, and create a remarkable future.
Both Aaron Clark of Rogers and DeAndre Jones of Fayetteville played a part in getting that bill put together. They say education is the first step in healing racial trauma.
It's about saying no to crime and drugs and violence. It's about standing up for atonement and reconciliation. It's about insisting that others do the same and offering to help them. It's about the frank admission that unless black men shoulder their load, no one else can help them or their brothers, their sisters, and their children escape the hard, bleak lives that too many of them still face.
Always a good day when we get to hear from former President Bill Clinton, shouldering our share of the responsibility. Old Bill Clinton, context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, October 11, 2021, so I have been told. Now, I guess it depends on what part of the world you are. Here in Washington State, they have a number of prominent signs for Indigenous Day, so-called. depends maybe on what part of the world you're in. Maybe it's Columbus Day. Maybe it's Indigenous Day. I don't know. Indigenous Peoples Day. We will see. Folks can share about that as we proceed. Our broadcast for today's program, try to be mindful about literature that comes out dealing with racism, white supremacy, actually twofold. So one, I try to see books that come out that are newer that deal with white supremacy, racism. Our guest for today's broadcast, brand new book, just came out a few months back, dealing with this subject matter, American Atrocity, the types of violence in lynching, a subject matter that we've talked about quite often over our time on the program. And even twofold, it's right there within the subject matter of the title, The History of Lynching Violence in America. But the Elaine, Arkansas massacre of 1919, we've talked about that on the program before. I know Cameron McWhirter, way back when he was on the program, in his book Red Summer, he talked about the numerous assaults that went down during that year, Washington, D.C., Arkansas, Chicago, not just in the South, notice. But we did talk about the Arkansas incident, and just back in 2019, there were a number of centennial events marking 100 years since the massacre, and trying to be more accurate, truthful about those events. I thought that was something important to discuss as well. Particularly, I try to say this often when we discuss, they were talking about Rosewood down in Florida and Tulsa, Oklahoma, recently, especially after they unearthed the burial ground, where they said, wow, it looks like it could have been 300, 400 victims of the Tulsa, Oklahoma massacre, purge of black people. And saying, Elliot Jaspin, we had him as a guest on the program some years back, his book Buried in the Bitter Water, major point that he made, hey, these are not random incidents. These are not isolated incidents. These types of racial cleansings, racial killings of black people specifically, have happened in this part of the world more than 260 times. And that's Elliot Jaspin in his book, again, Buried in the Bitter Waters. We said, just looking at the census data, like, this has happened over and over many more times than we know. Systemic white terrorism, very important. Elaine is just a part of that. Our guest for today's broadcast, in addition to the brand new book he published, American Atrocity, he's a freelance writer for the Arkansas Times magazine. Might even be able to share a thought or two on some of those reports. He's also dug into the archives of Arkansas state history, including some of the monographs of the 1919 racial cleansing in Elaine, Arkansas. We'll discuss his work today, some of his thoughts on what have been going on over this year, even comparing, contrasting the white terrorism that he discusses in the book with what has been unfolding this year. Rage in the air, rage at the schools. Looks like a lot of white people raging. So thankful to have him with us live. Our guest, Mr. Guy Lancaster. Mr. Lancaster, are you with us, sir?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Much obliged for sharing a bit of your Monday evening, Indigenous Peoples Day or Columbus Day, whatever it is for folks part of the world. For folks who have not seen you or not read your material, could you share a little bit of background information about who you are and the work that you do, sir?
Okay. My main job, I serve as the editor of the online Encyclopedia of Arkansas. It is a project of the Central Arkansas Library System that aims to offer a free and accessible and also historically accurate and honest portrayal of Arkansas state history. We have more than 6,500 entries online, and more than 200 of those pertain to individual lynching events. And we're continually digging up more and adding to that body of work. But I mean, we cover everything: railroad history, Civil War history, small towns. You know, it's designed to be an exhaustive resource. But I do also, aside from that job, as you mentioned, I'm a freelance writer with the Arkansas Times, which is a monthly magazine based here in Little Rock. And I also produce scholarship. My first book was very much like Elliot Jaspin's book. It was titled Racial Cleansing in Arkansas. And that book was based upon my PhD dissertation into the subject. And after that, I published a book, Bullets and Fire, which is an anthology of 10 articles covering various aspects of lynching in Arkansas. I've also published another anthology, The Elaine Massacre in Arkansas, which looks at the century preceding the Elaine Massacre and tries to put that into broader historical context to show that Elaine didn't exist, you know, in isolation, that since the very beginnings of Arkansas state history, this sort of violence was endemic. I was also proud to assist Griff Stockley, who wrote one of the, you know, truly great monographs on the Elaine Massacre, Blood in Their Eyes. I assisted him and another historian, Brian Mitchell, at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, in producing a revised edition of that, which came out last year. And then, as you mentioned, this year, just recently released, was American Atrocity, which is a thin book trying to analyze lynching from a variety of theoretical perspectives.
Spectacular. Much obliged for all of the detail. Reading more important than watching television. When you mentioned your work in archiving this material, the history, Arkansas state history, you said that there were approximately 600 different catalog records. I might be inaccurate with the number, but you said about 200 of those were for lynchings. Were those 200 like separate specific lynchings, or how was that 200 pertaining to lynchings? Can we get more, a little bit more detail?
Right. So the Encyclopedia of Arkansas has about 6,500 entries total, and more than 200 of those right now pertain to lynchings. And yes, that's 200 different events. And we have, if you want to go to the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, or just Google lynching in Arkansas, and it will come up. We have, you know, a brief history of lynching in the state, and we also have a chart that contains those that we've been able to document using a variety of historical resources. And that chart will contain links to several individual entries on individual lynching events.
We encourage folks to check it out, especially if we have folks in the Arkansas who reside in the Arkansas area or have any connection to that area. Say that regularly. Do some research on your state history. Glad I got that correction. So 6,500 entries, and then out of that, 200 are for lynchings, and then that's 200 separate incidents.
Right, and that's you know, maybe one half to two thirds. I mean, we're still producing material. We're putting, you know, new entries online every week or so. You know, not all of them are lynching related, but we have been able to add to that body of work quite a bit.
Wow. Much obliged. Let's see, for folks who have not seen you, this might be their first time hearing from you. You are a white man, Mr. Lancaster. Is that accurate?
I am.
Okay. This broadcast, the terms racism and white supremacy, I use the same definition for both terms.
Oh, are you asking me?
Well, I'm finishing my definition. I was just pausing.
Okay, okay.
It's racket in the background. I use the same definition for both terms, racism and white supremacy. The definition that I use for both terms is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
I think such a system does exist. It's reminiscent of the late philosopher Charles Mills, who unfortunately died earlier this year. He produced a book in the 90s called The Racial Contract, and he described white supremacy as sort of the unspoken world historical political system that has shaped, you know, our modern world. As far as equating racism and white supremacy, you know, he notes that racism, or that white supremacy, is sort of historically contingent. And he looks at a few other examples where, for example, the Japanese and their attitudes toward Chinese and Koreans, especially as manifest during World War II, as systems that exist outside of whiteness and that could have, you know, had history gone another way, become the dominant systems. So I think there's a possibility for racism outside of the confines of white supremacy. But I think because of the historical contingencies, just how our world has developed, white supremacy is the dominant system. And in many ways, you see other cultures imitate it to a great extent. Like you have a lot of colorism, for example, on the Indian subcontinent, a lot of oppression of darker skinned ethnic groups within India and Pakistan, and a preference for lighter skin. And you can, there have been articles about this sort of colorism within Bollywood, the Bollywood industry, for example. So, you know, there are still sold in India products for skin lightening, just as there were in the United States in the 1950s and 60s. So, you know, whether this is a sort of native colorism or imitative of white supremacy, perhaps linked to British colonialism, is probably for a historian of India to determine. I'm not aware enough to make that distinction. But yes, white supremacy is the largely unrecognized political system that has shaped our modern world.
Right on. Much obliged. Charles Mills, the late, as you pointed out, Charles Mills, also former guest on The Context of White Supremacy. We discussed that very book, The Racial Contract, way back in 2009. One thing that I do want to say before we get to your book and hopefully a few other questions as well, from questions from listeners. The book, also, the late, the book, Sundown Towns. Oh, they go again.
Mm-hmm. By James Lowen.
Yes, I needed the name. I needed the pause for the name, by James Lowen. He talks about the many ways that white people lie and conceal information about purges, like what happened in Elaine, Arkansas. And sometimes he would go to do research to find, like, get newspaper clippings and that sort of thing. And you talk about the same thing in your latest book. You go to research, it's like, dang, all the newspapers for this week are gone. That's so odd. How would they? The rest of them are here. What happened? Did someone do this deliberately to try to hide what was going on? And he talks about how that's a pattern where you see there's white people have committed some sort of terrorism and then they lie and conceal it. Another way that I've concluded that white people conceal and lie in practicing racism, white supremacy, using buckets of words. A lot of times when white people discuss racism, white supremacy, especially when they're conversing with a non-white person, they will not answer questions, and or they will do so in a very indirect manner. Meaning if you ask a question where it could take 10 words to give the answer, they will use 1,000 words, where you might even forget what question you asked. And another way, they will go off topic and bring in a lot of things that have nothing to do with the question, that sort of thing. Lots of different ways that white people practice deception. So I'll request, if you could, make every effort to be as honest as possible with us today and to answer questions directly. I love the detail. You're a historian, so that's why we wanted you to be on. But and I say that it's important because that question didn't really have anything to do with India and all the rest of it. I mean, they do sell skin bleaching creams here. That would be further evidence of white supremacy racism. But I say that because you said outside the context of racism, white supremacy, or confines, that was a C word. We're on the context of white supremacy. You said outside the confines, it might be possible for other forms of racism. Are you aware of any of these locations, areas that are beyond the confines, the power dynamic of white supremacy racism?
Well, no, not at present. I mean, not with the modern world, as it were. No, but I'm trying to think. I mean, we do see kind of racialized hierarchies in other parts of the globe, but right now in the modern world, there's really kind of no escape from white supremacy because it is sort of the globalized world.
The system of white supremacy does operate on a hierarchy. We talk about that all the time. The late, great Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, black get back, brown stick around, yellow is mellow, white is right. Lots of different people have used different phrasings to articulate the darker you are, the worse you're going to be treated. And even the victims, the non-white people, even, as you said, carry out this behavior either self-destructively, skin bleaching, and all the rest of it, and or mistreating other non-white people. Lots of manifestations of that here in the US and worldwide, but all of that is just further evidence of white supremacy, racism, unless I'm in error. But not to bog that, it's just super important to ask that question every time we start off. And more recently, I've been asking our white guests on the program. There was a non-white author. He wrote a report for a major publication a few years back. He was talking about racism, and he had one specific sentence in the quote, in the essay report. He said, white people are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I've been focusing just on the first portion of that sentence, asking our white guest, you're a white man, you've done a lot of studying of white people in Arkansas, white people in the US in general. Based on your studies, family members, people that you know, life experience, do you think that a substantial number of individuals classified as white are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism?
I have to say no. Just to use family examples, my upbringing, my parents are very conservative. They met in the military, so they had this, very military ethos. And any discussions of race often centered upon individual decisions. That there wasn't a system of racism. There were racists out there, but there was no systemic racism. And I remember having a conversation because we were watching the news. And I forget what restaurant it was, Jack in the Box or something. There was a news story about a group suing this restaurant chain because they went to, a particular outlet, and the waitress, they sat there for an hour and never got waited on, and they were the only black customers in the restaurant. And my mom's whole response to this was, well, they should have gone somewhere else. Very kind of market-based response. Like it was kind of upon them that they didn't get up and go somewhere else where they might be served. And I think a lot of that attitude kind of remains. She wasn't really upset at, the racism exhibited by the waitress and the management. She was upset at these people who, in her mind, persisted in putting up with bad service and then subsequently making an issue out of it. And I'll give another example if I may. And this is something of a kind of personal history. My uncle Paul was he ran a county line liquor store. I don't know if you have dry counties where you are, but here in the Bible South, there are many counties where you can't sell liquor. And so one of your most important institutions is the county line liquor store. It's the nearest place you can go if you live in a dry county. Well, he you know, ran this liquor store. And in February of 1999, and it's a rural liquor store between two very small towns. But in February 1999, he was murdered in a robbery. And anyhow, I helped out that summer. My grandmother, God-fearing Baptist that she was, had to run the liquor store in order to, you know, make a profit so that she could sell it, you know, show that it was a viable business and sell it to someone. So anyhow, I was helping out on weekends with a guy, my uncle's partner, Big Dave, guy who used to drive tractors. And anyhow, it's just, you know, another Saturday. I'm at the register. Dave's taking a nap in the back. And this one guy comes in, and he's a little nervous African-American man. And anyhow, Dave comes out of the back, and he suddenly straightens up, and he's Mr. Polite. And he says, how do you do? How do you do? And is talking to the man. And he says, you know, I want to introduce you to Paul's nephew here. And so introduces me, and he's just pulling out all the stops. And anyhow, this guy gets a six pack and goes. And, you know, I turn to Dave and I say, what was that all about? And he says, that's the man who found your uncle's body. And I say, well, that's weird, in introducing me to this man. And he says, you don't understand. I say, it's the man who found your uncle's body. Chances are there were several people who came in, saw what happened and left, because, you know, most of my uncle's clientele were black. This is Eastern Arkansas, Lowland Delta, cotton country. He says, but this is the man who called the police. And when he called the police, they took him down to the station and they held him for 8 hours trying to get him to confess that he did it. And Dave said, he knew what he was getting into and he did it nonetheless. So, you know, anytime he comes in here, you treat him with absolute respect. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that lately. You know, Dave, in his talk to me, wasn't being critical of the police who, you know, just unquestionably arrested this man, you know, took him down to the station, kept him there for 8 hours without access to an attorney or anything. He wasn't questioning that. He was saying essentially that this man's one of the good ones. You can treat him with respect. And so that's another case where it's a very individualistic notion, isn't it? He wasn't looking at a system. He knew that the system was corrupt. He knew the system was prejudiced, and, you know, he didn't think about that. But when someone stood up to that, he could admire it. But never questioning the unfairness of the actions of the police. And so I think you're right when you say, you know, many whites don't feel personally aggrieved, because a lot of whiteness is predicated upon holding the individual, you know, above all else and not looking at systems. That may be a long answer to your question, but.
Fascinating. I guess I'll get in. Sobriety would be best. Say that all the time. Probably say it at the end of this broadcast as well. Incidentally, I don't believe they have dry counties in Washington State, because here you can purchase liquor at the grocery store. So,
yeah,
I doubt they have that here. At any rate, sobriety would still be best. I would also include, much obliged for, we got two anecdotes about his mother. They should have went somewhere else. Personal responsibility, almost sounds like. And then response solids, in which this black male who, I guess, found your uncle and reported the police and what have you, like, he could have easily been a character in American Atrocity if this had been really, if this had been right now. Maybe yes, he just would have looked a little different, but easily, if this had been 1940s, 1930s, like, oh man, you are going to be lynched today, and then maybe we find out later on what really happened, or maybe we don't, and we're content with that either way. But he could have easily been putting his life on the line today or previously. Incidentally, since we have agreement, Mr. Lancaster seems like he's in agreement. Another way white people practice racism, white supremacy, and minimize all of this, in my view, when they use words like prejudice, discrimination, fairness, we heard unfair, but same thing, all of that, we are talking about terrorism. If you're talking about, all I'm doing is calling to, oh my gosh, it looks like they've had some sort of a crime, we've got a body here, and you call 911, and I could be killed or charged with this with no evidence, or they do the strong arm attack. Didn't you do it? Yes, you did. No lawyer, no food, and we're just going to hold you here. And Chicago, they call this terrorism. That's what they teach the children in the Chicago public school when they teach about Ed Berg. It's not prejudice. They said terrorism. And it's exactly what he just described, holding black people. Make them confess. We know you didn't do it, but that's all right. You're going to confess anyway. Call things by their proper name. Say that on the program all the time, because that is also systemic in not using correct words to describe all this. That is part of the a major, like, underline, highlight, boldface, print, major part of the confusion. Before we get to American Atrocity specifically, I wanted to ask, I was going to ask our listeners' question first, but I will pause and hold that. I will ask, I got to get in at least one Bill question, Bill Clinton question, since we have an Arkansas historian. What do you make of the remark when people say that good old Bill Clinton is the first black president?
I know what Toni Morrison meant when she you know, you used that analogy that looking at it in terms of someone being persecuted for personal sexual issues or whatnot, that is so, it bothers me so much, because he clearly could talk with a variety of audiences, and he, you know, exhibited personal comfort around people of color, but I just remember, so I've occasionally taught a class at the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service, which is a graduate school program founded by Bill Clinton, based here in Little Rock. But I went to one of my students' graduation, and he usually shows up. And this was, I think it was 2018, maybe. And there had been already, you know, plenty of conversation regarding police brutality and the like. And he made some comment. You know, he's always trying to achieve a sort of balance that, you know, can't we agree that both these activists and these police officers are okay people? And I just had this thought of, you don't get it. You don't see where the power imbalance lies. You know, he's a good talker, but he has no critical capacity, I would say. That's perhaps as gentle as I can put it.
I have heard Toni Morrison credited with that analogy, say all that all the time, the metaphors. Yeah, incidentally, I'm very critical I'll say it a different way. I generally reject any sort of analysis that even sounds like it's suggesting that a white person is poorly informed or not aware or something about that person's mental faculties. Prohibit them from understanding racism, white supremacy. In fact, that was the listener's question. Walked me right to it. Who do you think is more confused about what racism, white supremacy is and how it works? Do you think that white people are the ones who don't have this information, or do you think non-white people are lacking information about what racism is and how it works?
I think if we go back to Charles Mills, he had a great phrase he used in The Racial Contract, an epistemology of ignorance, by which he meant that so much of white society is constructed in such a fashion as to keep whites ignorant of the systems that advantage them. I think that's a very powerful analysis, because in a way it decenters the individual, right? You know, I talked about how my family and Big Dave were centering individuals. This idea of an epistemology of ignorance decenters the individual. And it shows that the way systems operate is in many ways to keep them ignorant of their advantages, you know, which is why you get, you know, whites who can say things like, well, I never had anything handed out to me, you know, because they're fundamentally not aware of the larger structure supporting them. You know, I think many people of color, there's some ignorance there, but it's not the same systemic ignorance. It's more, you know, I know people who are descendants of lynching victims, for example. One of my good friends here in Little Rock, Kwame Abdul Bey, discovered that one of his, like his great-great uncle, was nearly lynched and had been held prisoner in 1927, arrested for the allegedly murdering a young white girl, held in prison or held in custody, was denied access to food, water, forced to stand for like 12 hours until he confessed to the murder. But, you know, Kwame didn't hear this story growing up. He only learned the story long after he'd become an adult and someone else told him about it. And his family didn't pass that on because, you know, in part, they wanted to protect those who came after them and not burden them with that history. It's not the same level of ignorance, because they may not necessarily, you know, Kwame wasn't aware of his own, you know, familial past there, but he was already, you know, growing up black in Arkansas, already very well aware of, you know, the reality of racism, which, you know, many whites are not.
You said if that makes sense?
If that answers the question. Yeah.
Oh, okay. If that answers the question. Okay. That is an answer, for sure. Epistemological ignorance. I've pointed that out. I get to just sit back and point out things that I've talked about over years at this point. That's another one. Frequently, mm-hmm. I found when white people especially highlight again, underline, boldface print, especially when white people are practicing racism, white supremacy, master deception, they will give out inaccurate information and it will be attached to a non-white person, frequently a deceased non-white person, the late Charles W. Mills. I do remember that from The Racial Contract. I will just pick two bits of information. I get to hit two different books. Reading is more important than watching television. Number mm-hmm. one, we are reading Shaft. Oh, I love it, love it, love it, love it. Gusty picked that book. If it had been a vote, we would have been reading something else, but it was never up for vote. That was the book that we were going to read, period. We are reading Shaft by Earl Tidyman. I don't think I've spoken to one non-white person yet who was aware that the Shaft franchise, all those movies and Richard Roundtree and Gordon Parks and Isaac Hayes and Samuel L. Jackson, all of that is based on a book, or series of books, excuse me, written by a white man.
Huh. I had no idea either.
Ernest Tidyman. And they have pictures. He won an NAACP Image Award for creating John Shaft. The jokes that, wait till you read the book. My goodness, the booklet. So that's one. Two, staying within the theme of these racial cleansings, at least 260 of them, according to, or more than, according to Elliot Jasmine and evidence. One of them, Mr. E.R. Bills wrote about in Texas, beginning of the 20th century, when he was a guest on the program 2015 to discuss his book and what happened, same thing, hundreds of black people killed and they had a field day going out and shooting black people. One of the things that we discussed was he was going to write this book and he was saying that, man, a black person should write this book. Man, a black person should write this book. But he talked about, like, man, I had a hard time writing this book because frequently, same thing, you go to get the newspapers or you go to get documents, things are missing. Now you're left having to talk to the people who would know about this, the perpetrators and or their descendants who would be classified as white, to get details about what happened. What happened to the property of these people and all the rest of it? Did you give them a certain amount of time to get out of town and all that? Found himself talking to white people to get these details. And we both said, how would a black person get these sort of details?
Exactly.
Exactly. And exactly. Let that echo. Exactly. When we think about now, who would be more informed about what racism is, how it works? I'm going to get to my next question. Let's see. Before we get to the book specifically, American Atrocity, who did you write this book for? And then we'll get into the details about what it's about and all that. But who? What audience did you have in mind? Who is supposed to be reading this book for their benefit?
I guess I kind of had in mind while writing it some of my students, things that, you know, I had worked to explain in classrooms and issues I'd been challenged on. And so trying to more thoroughly articulate some of these ideas, particularly for students. You know, but also I think kind of for anyone who's broadly interested in this subject, I do try to eschew some of the academic tendency toward very opaque prose. I try to write more readably. I don't always succeed, but, you know, really, I would hope kind of anyone who's even slightly versed on the subject of lynching could pick this up and learn something from it. I pull from a lot of different sociological, psychological, even philosophical works to kind of create the frameworks I use to analyze lynching. But I think it should be accessible to a broader audience.
Fascinating, fascinating. I would say, Cal's listeners, if you read this book, you will see a lot of familiar network. Depending on how long you've been listening, if you've been listening for a long time, then you'll see lots of names like, oh, Amy Wood, she was a guest on the program, Lynching a Spectacle, and Philip Dre. You don't even have to have been a long listener. Philip Dre was just here this year. We talked about At the Hands of Persons Unknown and Ariella Gross. Now, that one, you'd have to be a long-time listener or in the archives, but What Blood Won't Tell. Lots of interesting information there, even about what it means to be white. That book is a great one, making it clear.
It's wonderful. What,
I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. I said it's wonderful. It's just an amazing book.
Mm-hmm. She was a great guest on the program. White one, all written by white people. Amy Wood, Philip Dre, Ariella Gross, experts on what racism, white supremacy is. So that's the audience, your student. What are the demographics of your students, by the way?
It's really interesting because the Clinton School pulls from pulls from across the nation, but also across the world. So, you know, I would have sometimes, you know, a few native Arkansans, some white, some black, a few people from outside the state, sometimes, you know, from the north, and, you know, always throwing things into relief. I would have students from across the globe, from places like Switzerland or Malawi or Egypt. And it's always interesting trying to talk about race, you know, with more global students, where things don't break down on, you know, the black-white paradigm, or things that may be controversial kind of in an American context would be completely not controversial in another context. You know, for example, we were discussing the idea of cultural appropriation in one of my classes, and I had a black student, you know, I asked her, so if I came in wearing a dashiki, would that offend you? And she said, oh, absolutely. And I had a student from Malawi in the same class, and I said, what about you? And he said, you know, if you came to my country, I would expect you to dress like we dress. So yes, I'd expect you to wear a dashiki. So it was a, you know, interesting contrast there. You know, my student from Egypt, he was a Coptic Christian, which is a persecuted minority in Egypt. So, you know, what's interesting is that here in the U.S., because of his ethnicity, he's often conflated with, I mean, he's Arab, but, you know, in the American mindset, Arab equals Muslim. So, you know, he gets kind of the anti-Muslim sentiment here in the U.S., whereas in, you know, back in Egypt, he gets the anti-Christian sentiment, you know, directed to him. So it's very, trying to teach such a diverse group is very challenging and also very rewarding. You know, I learned quite a bit doing this.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Mr. Guy Lancaster, joining us from Arkansas, one of the states I have not yet visited. With American or it's included in American atrocity. I guess we could kind of pick it up as we go. Could do that. We'll pick it up as we go. I'll get to one of my, or what I think is one of the more important passages in the text. I guess before I even do that, very important, you take time at the beginning of the book. I appreciate words are very important. Hope that's come across in this broadcast already. You take time to explain what we mean by lynching. Why did you think it was important to do that, and kind of share with our listeners your definition for lynching that you use in the book?
Right, because many, you know, I would talk to some students who assumed a lynching had to be a hanging. You know, they didn't understand that, you know, lynching could be a murder, that the noose was sort of incidental. You know, many victims were shot, or they were dragged behind a car, or they were set on fire or stabbed, you know. So we have this kind of paradigmatic view of lynching that sees it, you know, explicitly as a hanging, and that's not true. We have an idea that lynching, you know, the term rough justice is often used as a synonym for lynching. Whereas, especially in the fifth chapter of my book, discusses the fact that there were people who were lynched for, you know, they weren't even accused of a crime. You know, a number of people had eloped, you know, with their white lovers. And, you know, the newspaper accounts don't even make any pretense that, you know, a sexual assault had occurred. We know that many black men who were, you know, lynched for alleged rapes were actually lynched for consensual relationships, and, you know, the accusation of rape was sort of applied ex post facto. But, you know, these were instances where they admit, no, this guy ran away, you know, with this woman and she went willingly. She was seduced by him. And so they lynched him, you know. So, you know, it's important to set out, I think, at the beginning, kind of what sort of phenomena lynching entails. It's not always punishment for a crime. It isn't always a hanging. But there are, you know, very specific dimensions of violence within it. And, you know, you can't just substitute another word. I spend a little time, you know, looking at other words. If you went to a dictionary and or a thesaurus and looked up lynching, you might get words like assassination or murder, slaughter, massacre. But these, you know, have some overlap, but they're not, you know, exact synonyms. So I think I spend a lot of time spelling out, you know, my terminology, because I do want to be as accurate as possible and make people think about the term lynching, because it does get used so haphazardly.
Words very important. Let's see. Found the passage that I wanted to share, and I hear the metaphor. You even get some of that later on in the book, people using the metaphor of a lynching for all types of examples, saying that Donald Trump was lynched and Clarence Thomas was lynched and all the rest of it. And, you know, they didn't talk about those metaphors on Saturdays. The portion that I wanted to read, this is on page 33, relatively early in the book, which is not too long. You write, "These lynchings were designed for broad impact, to send a message of domination, to instill fear, and sometimes to drive African Americans from the community altogether. These lynchings, moreover, constituted but part of a broader tapestry of objective or structural violence. This will be explored more fully in Chapter 2, but it will be sufficient for now to note that this entailed the use of terrorism to relegate African Americans to a state of second-class citizenship and economic disadvantage that would last for generations after emancipation and create far-reaching consequences." And even you start off the book, you have, I think most of the victims that you present in the book are black males who constitute most of the lynching victims, but they did lynch black females as well. And you start off, you have a mulatto female who's been lynched, and you said that even raises more of a question, because you said so many of these lynchings are about a black male accused of rape or reckless eyeballing or whatever with a white woman. Why would this mulatto female be lynched? And then the body's been there for all this time, which is another component of the terrorism that you talk about in terms of sending a message. And then even the threats, you know, if this body is touched, the same thing will happen to you, that sort of thing. Just in terms of the widespread, this is not an individual incident. I think even Muhammad Ali talked about that with Emmett Till, like he wasn't even there for the lynching. Mm-hmm. And it had an impact on instilling that fear and know your place, be subservient. But why did you pick that, the incident with a mulatto so-called victim who was lynched?
I think it's because often how we, I love Amy Louise Wood's work on spectacle lynching, but I think a lot of people, you know, assume that spectacle lynching is the dominant form of it. You know, it certainly became very prominent, especially in the 1890s. But, you know, I raised the issue, and I think it's 1894 lynching here in Central Arkansas, the woman who's described as a mulatto woman who'd been there for several days, because it does raise questions about what we call a lynching. You know, many more classical definitions of lynching, those formulated by the likes of the Tuskegee Institute or the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching or the NAACP, you know, they created these definitions of lynching so that they could tabulate them, right? Produce their yearly tabulations. And, you know, often they entailed something like there had to be three or more perpetrators, and the motive had to be based upon, in some way, an idea of honor or Southern honor, white male honor, whatever. But what's, you know, very moving about this one event with the, you know, quote, mulatto woman, we know nothing about her. We know nothing about the perpetrators. So, you know, according to some of these more classical definitions, we couldn't classify it as a lynching because we don't know if there were the requisite three people there. We know nothing about the motive. All the sign hanging around her neck said was, you know, if you touch this body, the same thing shall happen to you. What on earth does that mean? So, you know, according to some of the more classical definitions, we couldn't call this a lynching, but yet it clearly functions as that. And if it functions as that, it is that. You know, this clearly was an incident designed to instill terror in the population. And I think all the more so because of the questions that, you know, go unanswered. You know, it's, if you were a black man in late 19th, early 20th century Arkansas, you could perhaps imagine, you know, or at least convince yourself that adherence to certain rules might keep you safe. Yeah, step aside for white people. Don't look them in the eye. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, practice obeisance and submission. You know, there were rules for behavior. What's the message here? Because we don't know what rules this woman broke. And in fact, you know, the fact that it is a woman raises even more questions because, you know, she couldn't likely have committed the acts. You know, she didn't rape anyone. She likely didn't kill anyone because that would have been reported. That would have been news. So this is an even greater instance of terror-inducing violence because it seems to come out of nowhere. And I think, you know, it also raises the question, do we know most of what happened? You know, it was a black church group on the way back to Little Rock who they found this woman. But how many people were hanging in trees in the woods and went completely undiscovered? Or they were discovered and instead of it being reported, they were, you know, buried and it kept quiet. You know, it's, I'm glad people are doing the work of compiling the numbers of lynchings. And, you know, of course, we're trying to do that work too. And as I mentioned at the top, we have, you know, an entry on lynching on the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, and we have an updated, you know, constantly updated tabulation. But, you know, I don't want us to find too much comfort, too much certainty in those numbers, because those numbers are just what we know about. There are, you know, there's no doubt an amazing number of murders like this that went unreported. And so, you know, the numbers we have, the numbers organizations like EJI have worked to compile, the Equal Justice Initiative, that's the tip of the iceberg. There's so much that lies beneath the surface that we may never recover, but the effects of that violence, you know, do continue to echo. They echoed throughout the decades, throughout the centuries, up to the present day. and we need to be aware of that.
This is a little bit later on in the book, and I already mentioned Tulsa, Oklahoma, I think regularly referred to as Black Wall Street. This is on page 38 of the text. You write, "The procession of cars dragged Carter's body unchallenged through the main thoroughfares of Little Rock, even driving by the county courthouse, city hall, and police headquarters." Now compare that with January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
"Even driving by the before finally stopping at the intersection of 9th and Broadway in what was then the heart of the Black Business District, home to the national headquarters of the Mosaic Templars of America, a black fraternal organization. There," Harp writes, "they placed Carter's body at the intersection of two streetcar lines, doused it with gasoline, and set it on fire using pews from nearby Bethel African Methodist Episcopal AME Church, Little Rock's largest African American church. The mob, estimated at between 4,000 and 7,000, which would have to be a substantial number of the city's population at that time, went riot for hours until the National Guard was called out to restore order. While all of this was going on, most of the police were apparently hiding in the basement of the headquarters, although some sources said..." Now, even that right there, I have to pause now.
Mm-hmm.
Who do I think would be a source to cite, "Man, the police were out here in the mob and they were doing such and such"? Like, anyway, "while this was going on, most of the police were apparently hiding in the basement of the headquarters, although some sources reported seeing officers mingling with the mob without attempting to stop the violence at all." Who could imagine such a thing? "In many stories of lynching, the role of the police is ambiguous. Often does a guard or deputy claim, after the fact, to have been overpowered by mobs." And we'll stop there, but I thought this was so important twofold, because this seems to happen frequently where a black person is accused of doing something. Maybe they did something, often they did not, but there's some sort of accusation, and we got to kill this black person, or many black people, or maybe all of them. We're going to go to the business district and do the lynching, and maybe do some attacking and killing there as well, probably, if they went riot for hours, had to get the National Guard. And in this case, they don't just get the business district, they go and get the largest black church at the same time. Can you respond to that?
I mean, it is shades of Tulsa. You know, West 9th Street was kind of Little Rock's own Greenwood. You know, a number of black-owned businesses. You know, the Mosaic Templars was an international organization that offered burial insurance, you know, and was sort of emblematic of black independence, because, you know, it was hard for African Americans to get, you know, burial insurance with white companies. So, you know, the founders explicitly founded this to provide that, you know, for their own people. But there were entertainment halls, you know, notable entertainment halls like Taborian Hall, where national figures came and performed. You know, this was one of the cultural hotspots of Little Rock. And, you know, as you say, of course, you know, they bring this man, John Carter, and he was arrested in it's now part of the city, but back then it would have been just outside of the city. He was arrested and lynched in far western Little Rock, and the mob, you know, strapped his body to a car, as you say, drove around all over the place, and they went to the heart of the Black Business District, where he was not known to have any ties whatsoever. But they burned him there to show, you know, essentially the mob was showing that they don't make any distinctions between, you know, these sort of middle class African Americans who lived and worked there and, you know, this random person who was arrested out in Western Little Rock. It's what the Norwegian philosopher Arne Johan Vetlesen calls the logic of generic attribution, right? That in the enemy group, you know, one person stands for them all. So this man who was accused of this crime, and even the accusation, you know, the nature of his crime is inconsistently reported on, you know, nature of his alleged crime, you know, he was just as representative, you know, in the white mind of African Americans as all these people who labored and worked in along West 9th Street. So, you know, they went there to make a point, to they went there to intimidate, they went there to terrorize, to instill terror in this population. And it worked. I don't know if you know this, but Elizabeth Eckford, who is one of the Little Rock Nine, who desegregated Central High School in 1957, Orville Faubus, the governor, stood against that, brought out the National Guard to try to prevent it, leading Eisenhower to nationalize the Arkansas National Guard, put under his control to facilitate the desegregation of the school. But Elizabeth Eckford has talked about the fact that her parents were very reluctant for her to take part in this desegregation because they remembered what happened in 1927, only 30 years ago. You know, the stories about John Carter have come down to the present day and, you know, nearly a century later. That terror has, you know, an intergenerational effect that I don't think is has been fully appreciated. You know, you talk about white ignorance. It's very, very interesting because a few years ago, the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center, which is the Museum for Arkansas African American History, which stands at the corner of 9th and Broadway, that same corner where John Carter was burned, they held an event about the Carter lynching, and with several historians as well as descendants of those who were on various sides of the affair. And the although sometimes inconsistent in the details, the story of Carter's lynching was lived in the Black community. You know, many Black residents of Little Rock who were there could tell stories about hearing this history. The history, however, had been obscured. You know, many white families, you know, even those who may have had like a genealogical attachment to some of those who were involved, hadn't heard the story. And, you know, I mentioned Kwame Abdul-Bey earlier, who's a descendant of one of those involved. You know, he knew the story. He'd heard the story, but he didn't know that he had a family connection to it. So, you know, yeah, it's another, we'll bring up Charles Mills again, Epistemology of Ignorance. What white populations are often very good at is forgetting this sort of history. You know, in my own research, I'd talk to people in various places, and it's interesting, you know, even some of my family members, you know, would say, yeah, there was a lynching in Cross County. I forget when, but yeah, I know the county had a lynching. Well, Cross County, you know, had like 10 lynchings or so, you know, but they remembered that, oh, there was a lynching once, no details, you know, about it, just knew very vaguely that one had happened when in fact, you know, several had happened. I'm probably getting somewhat off topic again, but.
For sure. I just wanted to, that I think is important as well. And I have just some, a bit of information that I think the evidence in terms of white people, they cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They will get in trouble with other white people. For sure. Lots of evidence on that one. Now, with Elizabeth and Hazel specifically, yes, I'm familiar. We read book club, lots of plugs. We read Elizabeth and Hazel, written by a white man, and we read Warriors Don't Cry, Melba Patillo Beals, back to back, in fact. In fact, not to get off subject, Elizabeth Eckford's son, is that a lynching?
I remember she referred to it as suicide by cop. Her son was killed by a police officer. I don't know all the details. I know what she called it. You know, there are many instances of police violence, I'd say certainly, you know, overlap with, you know, the lynchings we're talking about, and, you know, many cases where police participated or allowed. I'd hesitate to contradict Elizabeth Eckford on that. I don't really know the details all that much.
We talked about, it's in Elizabeth and Hazel, which kind of gives her perspective, and then Hazel Masterford, she's, I messed up the last name, but she's one of the white younger people who's in some of the images shouting and spitting and yelling at Elizabeth Eckford and some of the other students as they were going in for the first day way back 1957. And they kind of, you have to read it. Yeah, you can go back in the archives in the book or read it. It is why, and then she gets, you get to all that and reconciliation and all that and get to the end. And that's a great illustration of the same point that you just gave. Mr. Carter was not a member of the business community. There was no evidence that he knew anybody there, had any connection. Doesn't matter. Niggers is niggers. You're all the same. She displayed the same logic. Hazel Masary, she gets to the end after she and Elizabeth Eckford are no longer friends and hanging out and all the rest of it, and she's so disgusted with the experience, she says, well, I'm done, and you're going to ask me why I didn't vote for President Obama. Well, I didn't want to give him a chance. They didn't give me a fight. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait, what does President Obama have to do with there being some sort of issue? You and Miss Eckford are no longer friends. That happens. Friendships break up. What does that have to do with President Obama? What's the connect? Niggers is niggers. Make things simple. To get to, there was another important section, then I'll get to some of the folks who dialed in with questions. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question for Guy Lancaster. This is skipping for 61, page 61 of American Atrocity. You write, one of the means for perpetuating that social order was lynching. White mobs regularly. We have a black male educator. It's been working for 5 years attempting to teach, and all of this, all of these obstacles and them deliberately sabotaging his efforts. I thought of him immediately. I was going to see if I could screenshot this page so that he could read the highlight. Let me start over. He says, you write, one of the means for perpetuating that social order was lynching. White mobs regularly attacked educators and those who resisted being forced into the regime of plantation labor. In June 1897, for example, a mob attacked a black school in Lonoke County in central Arkansas and beat the local teacher, D.T. Watson. As one national newspaper report recounted, mob leaders told the Negroes that they wanted them to chop cotton. that they had enough education. Watson soon went missing, his body later being discovered hanging from a tree and bearing the sign, "A warning to nigger school teachers. We want none of this kind of people in this country." It didn't say county. The R is on the word. So in this country, others beware. Now, you want to talk about generational impact? You want to share a thought on this passage? Then we'll get our callers.
Well, it kind of goes back to a point I made earlier about, you know, we often have this vision of lynching as rough justice, frontier justice. You know, here's a case where, you know, the crime, quote unquote, crime, you know, was simply being a school teacher and trying to raise children to do something other than chop cotton. You know, lynching doesn't just stand outside the social order. You know, it's not the absence of law and order. Lynching, in many respects, is law and order. It's the social order. And so, you know, this man, this educator, was defying that social order, and, you know, they killed him. You know, and again, they did so unabashedly. You know, they didn't invent a crime for him to be accused of. They simply said, "We no longer want black school teachers in this country," as you noted. So lynching's a part of the economic order. It's a part of the social order. It's a part of the political order. You have to see lynching as tied to part of the broader structure. It's not the exception to the rule. It, in many respects, is the rule.
Context of white supremacy in this country.
Yeah.
Man. Enormous focus. And to see this consistently, attacks against black educators. The number again for listeners, if you all have questions, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Caller 5640. If you had a question for Mr. Guy Lancaster, you should be with us.
Hi, good evening, Gus, and good evening to the guest, Mr. Lancaster. I have three questions, if that's okay, Gus. The first question is, the lynching of Emmett Till caused by Carolyn Bryant, and then the lynching of Mary Turner, the pregnant black woman that was killed by whites in Lowndes County, Georgia. Do you think that those two examples are symbols of the many lynchings that were perpetrated against women and children?
Okay. Do you want me to go ahead and answer that or ask all three of your questions?
Oh, no, you can, if you could answer that first question. Yeah, I'd just like to know if there were hundreds or possibly thousands of lynchings, commonly against black men or black American men, but what about, would that hold true for black women, black American women and black American children as well?
There are, and I'm not sure I could give you an exact number, but, you know, I have come across, just looking at Arkansas, a number of lynchings of children. And usually they're in their mid to late teens. You know, about the age of Emmett Till, in fact. And sometimes, you know, there are discrepancies in the newspaper accounts as to someone's age. You know, one newspaper may say he was 16 and another newspaper say 18 or 20. You know, and I wonder sometimes if that's, you know, they're trying to ameliorate this. But, you know, if you do go look at, you know, some of the records in the U.S. Census, then you see that quite a few were actually, you know, in the mid-teens. You know, there was one, Jim Sanders, who was lynched, you know, here in Pulaski County in 1882. And he was, you know, very likely, you know, in his younger teens. He's actually referred to in newspaper accounts as a youth, who would have been possibly little older than 10 years old at the time. It's difficult to say. It's difficult to say that this, according to the census records, it says 10 years old, but it also notes that his birth year was estimated. So he could have been, you know, a young teenager, but, you know, that's the youngest lynching victim I know of in the state. And we've documented at least 8 women lynched in the state, 8 black women. You know, it's interesting that you see white men lynched, you see black men lynched, you see black women lynched, but I have not ever come upon the lynching of a white woman. But yeah, black women, you know, are not lynched with great regularity, so far as we know. But yes, that is documented too. Mary Turner, in fact, is something of a symbol for a lot of the themes that we've been discussing so far, because she wasn't accused of a crime. She, if I recall correctly, was simply, you know, refused to be quiet about the fact of her own husband's murder. So, you know, there you have, once again, the lynching of someone who is not, you know, accused of any sort of crime.
And to add to that, would you say that her baby, the whites cut out of her stomach and stomped, would you say that her baby was lynched?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. And then thank you for your answer. Then the next quick question that I have is, do you think that the descendants of the perpetrators of the lynchings are aware that their ancestors committed these crimes, especially given the fact that during these lynchings, pieces of the bodies of the victims were taken by the onlookers and those who perpetrated the crimes, and I understand that they still remain in a lot of people's homes. So do you think that that's the case?
I have to be a little circumspect here. I can tell you of, I'm not trying to protect anyone by being vague here, but just to protect the inquiry that's ongoing. I was once called by a woman who did find among her grandfather's effects a mummified finger that had been wrapped in leather, and included with this was a very old tattered newspaper clipping relating to an Arkansas lynching. So yes, some of these artifacts are still around. And she called me to ask what to do with this. You know, this was many years ago, and I had no clue. I had to call around, and we eventually did get it to a research facility where it could be analyzed, and perhaps if we can discover a descendant, you know, do DNA analysis and make some sort of match. But, you know, she didn't want to talk about it a whole lot. But she had not been aware, and this was in her grandfather's effects, and she actually was going through her grandfather's effects because her father had recently died. And you know, her father, I mean, just the generations that accumulated, she was going through everything. And it sort of boggles the imagination to think that her father didn't know that this was here. And so why did he save it? You know, if he had been sufficiently ashamed, why not get rid of it? You know, he could have just as easily thrown it in the trash and be done with it. But no, for some reason, her own father had saved it. And, you know, she, to her credit, was interested in getting this to some place where, you know, it could be perhaps linked to the crime. A descendant could be informed, and, you know, it could be eventually buried with respect. But, you know, I've talked to, you know, other people. One man who there was a Texarkana lynching in 1892, lynching of a man named Ed Coy, who was set on fire. And this man had discovered among family possessions a number of glass negatives that his family had run a photography business in Texarkana for generations. And he was able to get these processed. And some of them depicted, you know, the lynching of Ed Coy, both him, you know, when he was on fire and also afterwards. And, you know, he contacted me to see where he could, you know, send these photographs. And they are in the collections of the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, which is the genealogy and Arkansas History Division of the Central Arkansas Library System, where I work. You know, so we have these archived now to be preserved and used for historical analysis. I think, excuse me, I think some descendants are aware. I think others aren't until they come upon, you know, and items like this, you know, had no idea, because, you know, at some point we see the mob at the time acting with tremendous impunity, and they are not at all hesitant to pose for photographs with the lynched man's body. You know, but later that becomes not so respectable a thing. And so there's some level of shame, or at least of a feeling of necessary secrecy that gets attached to some of this. And so, you know, that kind of history doesn't get told. You know, again, an example from my own family, my grandmother, it wasn't until like the last year of her life where she started talking about some of the things she experienced and some of the things that, you know, she was aware of regarding race and violence at the time. And she mentioned that, you know, my great-grandfather, she said, had been involved. She was vague on the details at the time. You know, she said, I think your great-granddaddy, he was involved in putting down some kind of union, some kind of farmers union. And this was northeastern Arkansas. It would have been the 1930s. And I said, are you thinking of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union? She said, well, that might have been it. Well, the Southern Tenant Farmers Union was one of the rare integrated unions operating in early 20th century Arkansas. It was actually founded in a place called Tyranza. And, you know, my grandparents lived in just the county next door. And, you know, there was a tremendous planter-led violence against the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. And she told me that they were involved in attacking some sort of church over near Earl. Earl being, you know, the a town in, you know, just over the county. Well, as it happens, and this is, you know, you talk about Arkansas, small town, whatnot. I have a friend and colleague, Carmen Williams, who teaches in the Department of English and Philosophy at Arkansas State University. She's an African-American scholar with longtime Arkansas ties. And, you know, not long after my grandmother told me this story, you know, we were chatting and she said something about going to a church homecoming kind of thing. I said, oh, what church? And she said, oh, it's, you know, family church. It's over in Earl. You know, that's where most of my family is. You know, the church was, you know, kind of a refuge and, you know, center for organizing, you know, in the 1930s or so. There was some Southern Tenant Farmers Union meeting that was attacked there. And it's just, here's the intersection of two stories. And I said, I don't know all the details, but I think my family might have been involved in attacking your family. You know, it's that kind of history. More of us are implicated in that. More of us are tied together in that than I think people realize. And, you know, as mentioned earlier in this segment, you know, there were 4,000 to 7,000 people in the mob that burned John Carter's body. You know, that means how many descendants did they have? You know, thousands upon thousands of people who have a connection to that. Most of them probably don't know it. Some of them probably do know it and aren't talking about it, don't want to talk about it. You know, I've encountered that sort of attitude too. A number of people who kind of want to stick their head in the sand. But, you know, chances are all of us are tied to this history in one way or another. I think I veered off topic a little bit, but.
No, that's very helpful. Thank you. And then thank you for that. The last question is, and I asked this of another guest as well on a previous broadcast, on the perpetrators of the lynchings, the white males mostly, and white women as well. I know many of them, most of them were native-born whites, but were there also white immigrants who had recently immigrated to the U.S. who also participated in these crimes?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, there's a book I'll recommend to you. It's called Lynching to Belong by a woman named Cynthia Scove Nevels. She wrote about lynchings in Texas that had immigrant involvement. And, you know, the thing is, you know, what we call white today isn't necessarily what was considered white, you know, back in the 1800s, early 1900s. You know, many Italians, Greeks, Hungarians were, you know, considered marginally white, if, you know, white at all, you know, especially those of Catholic religion. You know, white was the nexus of, you know, a lot of different ideas. And, you know, many of these European groups, especially Slavic European groups, weren't seen as fully white. Well, one way one becomes white is by exhibiting violence or antipathy against African Americans. You know, this is something that Ariella Gross goes into. Those, you know, native tribes that achieved federal recognition were those that excluded, you know, African American descendants from, you know, membership. Likewise, those groups that succeeded in those immigrant groups that succeeded in becoming white were those that adopted American anti-blackness, white American anti-blackness. And, you know, her what she discusses happening in Texas, there are some instances I've discovered happening in Arkansas. There's one race riot that occurred in Polk County, which is in southwestern Arkansas, in 1896. They were constructing what became the Kansas City Southern Railroad, and among the railroad workers were a number of immigrants, especially Swedes and Hungarians, but also black railroad workers. Well, what ended up happening, you know, the locals, you know, said, we're not going to have any black workers, you know, in our county. It was a predominantly white county. James Lowen, you know, described it as one of those sundown counties where for several censuses, for several censuses, there were no African Americans recorded residing there. Well, what happened was local whites teamed up with those Swedes and those Hungarians to murder and drive out black railroad workers. And this is something you see across the United States. You know, many immigrant groups did adopt, you know, the sort of white anti-blackness as a means of laying claim to their own belonging.
Well, thank you so much for your detailed answers. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Gus.
Well, thank you.
Yes, Mo thank in you. Dallas, did you have a question for Guy Lancaster? You should be with us, sir.
Yes, I do. Can I be heard clearly, Gus?
Crystal.
Thank you. Thank you for the program. Greetings to the listeners and callers, and thank you to the guests for your attendance. My first question goes back to one of his childhood anecdotes. He said that I believe his relative had a county line liquor store, and after he had passed, he worked with a fellow named Big Dave. Big Dave told him that he could treat the man who found his uncle's body with respect. My question is, how did he treat black people usually at that age? And how did he treat this man differently if he saw him again? Or how would he treat this man differently if he saw him again? That's question one.
How would Big Dave treat? Or
No, sir, you.
Oh, me?
He said you to treat him with respect. So how would you treat that individual who found your uncle differently at that time to any other black people that you would usually come in contact with?
I actually never saw him again. I you know, that was the one time he came into the store. So I never had the opportunity to meet him again. And I don't think he was at the funeral either. But, you know, I will say that, you know, I don't want to impugn Dave too much. He was friendly to most, you know, of the clients, but it was that sort of friendliness that covers over you know, some generalized distrust. And, you know, I'll say too, it was, you know, working at a county line liquor store really makes you aware of how much, you know, how profitable misery can be, I guess. And what I mean is, you know, here, economic oppression, you know, drove many of these people into misery, and relief from that often took the form of liquor, you know, which my family would sell them, and, you know, plenty of others too.
Can I pause for a second, Mr. Lancaster? My apologies for interrupting you, sir. Mo in Dallas, was your question about how he treated the black people, or was your question about how Big Dave treated the black people?
The question was directed to him and his mistreatment, not Big Dave, how he would treat a black person who he was told he could respect, as opposed to how he would treat a black person just that he had no instruction to respect. That's what I was trying to say.
I was trying to find
the difference in the speaking.
I see. I did try to treat everyone who came in with respect. I was, you know, honestly somewhat, I guess, confused by, you know, Big Dave singling this man out and making such a big deal. And, you know, it sort of drives home the fact that, you know, a lot of whites, you know, I think, and especially older whites, do that. They single one person out and say, you know, oh, treat this man with respect, and, you know, he's my friend or whatever. In a way, is kind of to convince them that they are, you know, that I am a good person who, quote, doesn't see color or whatever. You know, they pick one person to be sort of the friend or object of respect so that they can continue in their more disrespectful lines of behavior, you know, throughout the day.
Would you say like a favorite black person or something?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I think I see that a lot.
Okay. Gus asked you a question that was induced by an author. No, this is a different question. The ignorant question: who's more confused about racism? You said, and I think your response was, the system is structured to keep them ignorant of their advantages.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you: the system is structured to keep them ignorant to their advantage. Them? Are you talking about them and their? As them being black people or white people?
White people.
Just so I can be clear.
Now, yeah,
okay, it's white people. Oh, so,
right.
So white people are ignorant to their advantages?
Right. Very often. And often, they'll kind of, this is something that's been analyzed too, sort of construct ancestral disadvantages. There was a historian who wrote a book called Roots 2 about the white quest for ethnic identity, that genealogy and interest in, you know, ethnic identity really took off, you know, among whites with the civil rights movement. And he sees this as sort of a counter reaction to the civil rights movement. Whites going back and discovering their immigrant ancestors so that they can say, oh, you know, well, my ancestors came from Poland without, you know, a single cent in their pockets and ended up building a business. And, you know, if my ancestors could do it, why can't these African Americans lift themselves up? You know, so interest in white ethnic background often was a means of, you know, dismissing the larger structures of white supremacy that exist in the United States. So, yeah, whites are you know, the system of white supremacy makes whites ignorant of many of the advantages they have, but also they go out and seek sort of confirmation that they are okay, they did it right, and if these other people don't succeed, it's based on some inherent flaw.
Okay, and my follow-up question to that is, since you are a historian and you have researched and interviewed, I'm assuming, more than one white person, would you, in your personal opinion, believe that these people that you have deemed ignorant of their advantages, are they legitimately ignorant, or would you say that they are weaponizing confusion in a way to sort of not to hide shame? I'll say it that way, to hide some sort of shame or obfuscate accountability.
I think there's a mixture of both, and sometimes it's really hard, you know.
Which would be more prominent in your opinion? Like 51%.
If we're looking, you know, like 51%, I'd probably lean 51% toward weaponizing shame, just because right now it's increasingly harder to be ignorant, I think. You know, one of the things that's broken into the white public consciousness more and more is the reality of police violence. You know, the technology has made possible for us to bear witness to that again and again and again. And so I think right now, you know, with these challenges to worldviews that may previously have been rooted in, you know, structural ignorance, I think right now we're seeing more and more weaponized shame, which is why we're seeing such reactionary politics on the right. That's the way I'd lean.
Okay, and my final question.
1 second, Mo and Dallas, because other people put their hands up on to try and nab folks as I'm able. Let's see. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
For sure. Let's see. Our caller in Georgia, did you have a question for Mr. Guy Lancaster? Our caller in Georgia, are you with us? Oops.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. I guess Dr. Lancaster, you said you wrote a dissertation. Congratulations on that. Dr. Lancaster, you said that you were a producer of scholarship, which is a fascinating choice of words, and I really do appreciate that. And I believe you identified yourself as a white person. So as a white person who is a producer of scholarship, I guess one question, I heard you talk about the kind of products you produce, but what is the overall goal of this, of the scholarship that you produce?
Well, I would hope that the overall goal is to make this reality, if I and others who work in this field can keep at this, we can see the study of racial violence. We can make it no longer separate from the concourse of American history. It will be necessary to include it. You know, it's no longer an exception to the rules of American history. I hope it will become more and more necessary to include it into the mainstream of American history, where, you know, our textbooks, if they do treat race and violence, no longer treat it at the side, but instead incorporate it into the broader narrative, so that we get narratives we can actually use to understand our reality. As far as, yes, I did produce a dissertation. I do hold a doctorate, but When I called my grandmother to tell her I had successfully defended my dissertation, she said, "When I told you I wanted a doctor in the family, I meant an MD, someone who earned some money. PhD just stands for poor, hungry doctor." So, and anytime people call me Dr. Lancaster, I hear my grandmother in the back of my head. So I'm fine with Mr. or whatever. Call me Guy. But
well, I mean, no. I'm respecting the work that it takes to do that. I know you can just
I appreciate that.
Pop up. Okay, second question. Thank you so much for that answer. Do you believe the work that you do, the product that you produce, does it support white supremacy? I guess that would be a yes or no, answer. And whichever you give, can you provide either evidence or details to support your yes or no answer? Thank you.
Oh, yes, very much so. And I would say just, I think one of the things we're unaware of, as Americans is just the sheer amount of violence that was used against Black populations. I did my dissertation and my first book on racial cleansing, and often, I would just have census figures for, there was X number of African Americans in this county in 1910 and zero in 1920. Something happened in between. And, this was before newspapers had begun to be digitized at a large scale. So often my research consisted of going to the archive, sitting in front of a microfilm reader, and just scrolling through 10 years. And if you just scroll through years of a newspaper, you can see reports of violence happening, every week. That, here I was looking for one local incident, but I would see reports of, lynchings that had happened elsewhere in the state, reports of lynchings that had happened nationally or, other events. Almost constantly, I think we're unaware of just the sheer magnitude of the violence that was employed.
Okay, I'm not that surprised by your answer, but I do thank you for it. And just very quickly, I'm trying to go fast. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry, guys. But even though the work that you do, and you said, you can't speak for the others, but you did say that the work that you do promotes white supremacy. Do you think if you knew your work, because it sounds like you're gathering a lot of facts, was able to be used to dismantle white supremacy, would you continue doing it? Would you stop? And would you be able to, give that evidence to Black people for reparations?
Oh, if I knew, this would help dismantle white supremacy, I'd open a bottle of champagne. I believe that it will help, because I believe that, the work I and others are doing are helping to dismantle some of the central myths. I would just love to dismantle white supremacy. I realize that sounds like a kind of very pie in the sky goal, but I believe that, any little bit helps.
Well, hopefully you pass that information on to those families if you truly believe that your work can help.
And I've been
Thank
working.
You. Those are the only questions I have. Well, you can continue.
Yes, and I have been working with the Arkansas Peace and Justice Memorial Movement, which has been working to install markers across the state, acknowledging these lynchings, and also has been reaching out to descendants as we can identify them. So, yes, that's one of the forms this work has been taking.
Chair, Cherry in Atlanta.
Thank you.
I wanted to get her in as well. Much obliged, caller in Georgia. I did want to make sure, because I just said this on Saturday. Like, I think that was the first time I said we were talking about the Equal Justice Initiative mentioned in the broadcast today and the markers for different victims. And I said this then, so I'm just consistent. Sobriety would be best. I say that all the time. And those markers, I said, I do not think that is constructive at all. I know one of the points that they made, the Equal Justice Initiative, talking about, I think, wow, we have greatly minimized the number of black people that were killed, terrorized throughout the history of white supremacy, racism. We would be drowning in markers. And I guess there's lots I could say about that. But the final point would be, they just said the Emmett Till, or one of the Emmett Till markers, was stolen. Mm-hmm. Apparently, these markers have been vandalized, shot at, attacked. They had to get bulletproofing for the marker.
Yeah.
That's all I'll have to say about the constructive value of lynch markers. The caller, Cherry in Atlanta, did you have questions?
Yes, just one question. First, good evening to everyone. And my question for the guest was, as a historian, do you find that terrorism and hatred are foundational characteristics of white culture? And why or why not?
I mean, when you say white culture, you know, I would say whiteness in, you know, the respect that we mean, whiteness is sort of this overarching system, you know, has only been produced by terrorism. I don't like the term hate or hatred so much, because I think that psychologizes and also individualizes, you know, it makes it easier to speak of hate crimes as an individual thing, something that someone perpetrates because, well, they have hate in their heart. Well, that's not the case at all. They, you know, may have hate in their heart, but a lot of this stems from the cultural messaging they are receiving from society at large. So, you know, whiteness as a construct, whiteness in the terms that historians like Ariella Gross or philosophers like Charles Mills discuss it, is something that has only arisen through practices of colonization, victimization, subjugation, and the likes. So, you know, it's not that all whites are acculturated toward hatred, but that whiteness itself has only arisen through a project of domination.
Terrorizing individuals classified as not white.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Cherry in Atlanta. We had, let's see, the caller at 3098, want to make sure we got him in. Actually, before I got him in, I wanted to make sure, because James Loewen has been mentioned. I said I find it so important. James Loewen, like Charles Mills, just passed away recently, mm-hmm. lost many this year.
Yeah.
And the mainstream newspapers, I don't know about the Arkansas Gazette, but mainstream articles, when they reference James Loewen, they always reference lies my teacher told me. Should be lies my white teacher has told me. I said that frequently, but whatever. I said, man, the book they should be talking about is Sundown Towns. I did not see that book mentioned in any of the reports. It was always lies my teacher told me. Like, he wrote a lot of other books. Like, why is that the only one that they are mentioning? From the book we read, Sundown Towns, just about white people being ignorant about the police. Again, I find that important and suspicious as well, when a white person hangs on to the narrative that white people are ignorant about racism. Like, oh man, that's like insisting that 2 plus 2 is 10. We're getting to the caller. Just give me 1 second to read this. This is James Loewen from Sundown Towns, the chapter Driving While Black. James Loewen writes, sundown suburbs near cities with sizable African-American populations are especially likely to rely on their police and the notoriety in the black community they earn to stay white. Mary Pat Baumgartner pointed this out about Hampton, her pseudonym for a New York suburb. Since residents cannot do away with arterial streets altogether, however, they turn to the police to scrutinize those who use them. Residents of sundown suburbs expect and applaud police harassment of outsiders. That does not sound like white people being ignorant about racism or police abuse of black people, specifically. Sundown towns, reading more important than watching television. Our caller just opened your line, sir. I just heard you. We heard you. Proceed. Last four digits, 3098. You there? 3098?
Yes, yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. I was on the call. Mr. Lancaster, good evening. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, callers and listeners. I'm going to start from the earlier time. What should be done, Mr. Lancaster, if you offer your opinion? What should be done about the participants of the lynchings that were identified, such as the one in the person that you gave your anecdote about earlier?
You mean the perpetrators?
Yes. That, like I said, you see there, like you said, you mentioned they were willingly posing photographs and such. Mm-hmm. What should be done, like you would, what should be done with people that once they identified, such as the person you identified with the mummified finger anecdote that you gave earlier?
Right. And, you know, that's a hard question to answer. In a handful of lynching reports, we have the names of perpetrators. In many, we don't. They just sort of become this anonymous mob. In fact, there was a 1904 lynching in Newport, Arkansas, where, you know, the mob marched down the main street, broke into the jail, took a man outside the city, hanged him from a railroad trestle, you know, all in the bright of day. And, you know, the coroner's report, despite all these facts, noted that, you know, this person found his death, quote, at the hands of persons unknown. You know, there was a lot of protection of the mob, you know, the identities of mob members at the time. And it's been difficult, even when we have pictures, necessarily to link that up to individuals. You know, it's been a challenge. And, you know, as I told the person who discovered the finger among her grandfather's possessions, you know, her grandfather would have been a child at the time of that murder. So, you know, he could possibly have been in the mob that lynched this man, you know, as a participant. But it could also be that he was given, you know, this finger as a keepsake by some older relative or friend of the family or something. You know, we can identify, you know, this person's grandfather, but we don't know what role he played. I do think whenever we can, naming these people, you know, is important when we can discover, the names of the members of the mob. I would like to erase, this legacy of anonymity that has, you know, clouded our history. You know, what value is there? You know, we talk about reaching out to descendants of you know, the victims. I think reaching out to some of the descendants of the perpetrators is also important. You know, in just, I think we'd be shocked at how many of us have, you know, ancestors like that. Because as has been noted, that lynching of John Carter in 1927, 4,000 to 7,000 whites were part of that mob. So, you know, they have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of ancestors by now. No, but I think making people aware that this isn't only our national history, this is also, you know, their family's history, can you know, perhaps help break some of this culture of denial that has been so deeply rooted.
Thank you for your answer. Follow up. Thinking about more tangible things, do you think it'd be possible for the descendants of victims to possibly pursue direct reparations from descendants of the perpetrators?
I don't really know. You know, it's, I mean, we have conversations about reparations for slavery, and we have conversations about reparations for, you know, there was a, I forget her name, woman who was more than 100 years old testifying before Congress relating to the Tulsa massacre, because she was there, you know, that's someone living, you know, for whom we could provide some compensation. You know, I think it's incumbent to recognize that it wasn't just the mob. You know, in many instances, the police failed to act. Political leaders gave their endorsement to the mob. So, you know, it was also a failure of the state, or in many respects, not a failure. The state succeeded. We need to think of lynching as political violence when police officers or politicians fail to act. They are choosing a side. Lynching is state violence. And so I think the better route, rather than seeking out individual families, you know, descendants of the mob, is, yes, seek them out, but also to recognize that these lynchings implicate far more than just the individual mob. I'd hate for them to be singled out and, you know, these broader structures be held innocent. This implicates, you know, more than the mob. The state was part of the mob in many respects. And so we need to pursue that, you know, in some of the same terms that we're looking at for reparations for slavery, that there's a larger political and economic system that lay behind the perpetration of this violence.
Much obliged.
Fascinating.
Much obliged, sir. Thank you for your question. Mr. Lancaster, we had two other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Did you have time to get our last two callers?
Sure, sure.
Awesome. I will make sure I get in. Like, that is so not cool. I'll say it that way. It's the mildest way ever. That is so not cool. Like, we were here for the first hour, and I was checking, looking for hands. Like, oh, they're spectating. No problem. I got my other little questions I can get in. Delectable Negro, my favorite book I can reference. And then they waited until about an hour and 30 minutes in, and then lots of hands went up. These aren't people that even, like, just started listening. A lot of these folks have been here from the very beginning, like, waiting till the last minute. Not cool. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a question, our caller in California. All right, if you had a question for Mr. Lancaster, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Greetings, guests. Greetings, guests, callers, and listeners. Mr. Lancaster, you said in your article that Americans need to incorporate this history into our broader culture and come to terms with it, lest the general framework that made such atrocities acceptable remain hidden, unacknowledged, and allowed to emerge again. And with this statement comes to mind a question. Should non-white people, especially Black people, should we be thinking that white people could erupt at any moment and do one of these massacres again that they've been doing since they even contacted us?
I mean, what was January the 6th? That was a modern lynch mob. It's not that, white people's group might explode into violence, but, there remain people who are invested, heavily invested in a certain understanding of what America means, and what America means for them excludes a whole lot of other people. And they are willing to use violence as a tool to defend or achieve, this vision of America that they have. And I think that's what we saw with the raid on the Capitol. That was a white supremacist mob. A mob that had been raised upon, some of these traditional American narratives, had seen these narratives challenged, especially in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. A lot of this had been building for so long, and, were willing to use violence to reinforce their worldview. So yes, those people are still out there, and those people are still willing to use violence, and it's a larger subset of people than you might think. It's not just the militia types. I mean, we've seen one by one, ostensibly respectable, Republicans falling in line in support, at least after the fact, of this mob, and support of this mob is becoming one of the touchstones of radical conservative politics. That kind of dark energy is still there, waiting to be tapped into, by the right people who can exploit it.
Another question, if I may, Gus.
Yes, sir.
I have to first share with you this concept of justice, which is guaranteeing no one is mistreated and those who need help receive constructive help. With all these, do you think this is possible on planet Earth? With the white mobs and white people who just seem to be only focused on mistreating people?
Well, I mean, the thing is, whiteness as a concept, it has its grounding in history. It's not, genetic. It developed over centuries, and has been kind of refined, especially in the American context. And, what has been constructed in whiteness, white supremacy, is a historic construct. What has been constructed can be deconstructed. Part of the mysticism, the magic of whiteness, is people don't realize how much it's not natural, that it's based upon certain historical contingencies and circumstances. So yes, we can deconstruct it. It's going to take a larger commitment to break that down, but I do think it's doable. And I think it's doable because looking through the history, we can see how whiteness was made. So maybe we can develop some tools to unmake it. It's not ontological. It's not essential. It's not, like one of the forces that holds together our universe. It's in some ways a historical accident. It didn't have to arise. But it's arisen, and we can tackle it.
Do you know any methods of motivating white people to get serious about establishing this justice and to stop them from practicing racism?
He said one other question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, sir.
Do you want to answer concisely, maybe?
Oh, concisely? You're asking me for a concise answer? I know a number of groups that are pursuing all kind of different efforts. I think some of them have value. Do I know of any single magic bullet? Not yet. It's the sort of thing that's going to take a lot of work in a lot of different spheres of our society.
Metaphor.
Thank you, guys.
There.
Thank you. Silver bullet.
Silver bullet metaphor. Point that out on a regular basis. And he just asked things to motivate white people. Like,
yeah.
Wow. There seem to be lots of things that motivate white people to practice racism, white supremacy. Uppity Negroes, non-white president, census numbers saying it's a lower number of white people, unhappy with election results, like lots of things. Get them riled up. We need to go and mistreat black people. Mm-hmm. Produce justice. Eh.
Yeah.
That is amazing. But if anything, the definition that I gave at the very beginning of all this was a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated. Very important word, dedicated. Mm-hmm. Our caller in Michigan, if you had a question for Mr. Guy Lancaster, you should be with us as well. Proceed.
Yeah. Thank you, Gus. I apologize for jumping in a little late, but I am intrigued by, you know, the large, like the gentleman said, large crowds and how apparently how frequently this was happening in just one state. So I was just wondering if he had any of the statistics, like how many, over what period of time, how many people were, you know, murdered. Were any of the mob participants ever brought to justice, that kind of thing?
A lot of people ask me, you know, as relates to Arkansas, how many lynchings did we have? And, you know, the number fluctuates depending upon what you're counting as a lynching. The Equal Justice Initiative includes, you know, the some 200 who were killed in the Elaine massacre. There are some scholars who don't consider that a lynching since, you know, state troops participated in it. So, you know, to them, it smacks more, you know, less of kind of the vigilante violence we associate with lynching and more of the state-sponsored massacre we see with maybe like the anti-union Ludlow massacre in Colorado, 1912, or, you know, like massacres at Wounded Knee. But, you know, so far as numbers go, there was a dissertation done in 1999 by Richard Buckaloo, and he identified 318 lynchings in Arkansas, and that's not including those who are murdered at Elaine. We've added significantly to that number, and the earliest lynching actually in Arkansas goes back to August of 1836, and that's a man, we only know his last name, Bunch. He lived in Chico County, which is in southeastern Arkansas, and was a majority black county due to slavery. It was a cotton-rich county. This man, however, was a free black man who tried to vote, and when told that he wasn't eligible to vote, he became irate and ended up having a confrontation with a white man, excuse me, and after that being lynched. So I think it's very interesting that you know, the first documented lynching goes back to 1836, the year Arkansas became a state, and relates to a man trying to vote. You know, again, it just sort of reinforces what I've been saying, that lynching isn't just vigilante justice. It's tied to political domination. It's tied to economic domination and exploitation. The last documented lynching in the state, and, you know, this is when you start entering the mid 1900s, you get a lot of murders that aren't typically classified as lynchings. You know, I think there's a definite continuum there. You know, lynchings kind of go underground, as it were. People just disappear. There aren't these public performances of violence so much. but the last documented lynching we have, it takes place in 1936. A man named Willie Keyes was lynched. So, you know, here in Arkansas, I mean, we've got a literal century of documented lynchings. And that doesn't include the Elaine Massacre. And that doesn't include some of the murders that occurred in the civil rights era. And we're finding, you know, new events all the time. I would say the state of Arkansas, you know, just throwing out an estimate and understanding that, you know, this is just an estimate, and that there's a lot of uncertainty relating to these numbers, but we probably have about 400 or so. And, you know, as I say, you know, our tabulation has been growing. You know, we do discover new events, especially as newspapers are digitized and become searchable. There are some things that were reported in out-of-state media that weren't reported in state media, or some things that were reported in very local newspapers that weren't reported beyond that. So, you know, the increasing digitization of newspapers is really opening multiple avenues into the study of racial violence. That's my long and unconcise answer to your question.
Okay. And does that include like the police violence, or is that
it doesn't include you know, police violence, civil rights murders, or, you know, the ongoing violence, you know, that we see today. So these are more of the historic lynchings. But as I say, there's tremendous continuity between them and now. And that's a point I make in the conclusion to American Atrocity, you know, that we shouldn't see lynching as having a historical end. Instead, the forms of violence transform, you know, through the 20th century.
And so in essence, you're still counting but not reporting how many?
Well, it gets complicated because, you know, historians today are not unified on what exactly gets labeled a lynching. So at least with the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, we're operating with a more conservative definition. And as scholarship expands that definition, we will expand, you know, what we cover, in the encyclopedia.
Well, you know, to me, if this is a problem that, you know, there's interest in solving, that any and all would get counted, especially modern day ones where, you know, that are involved with authorities and, you know, all the missing people that don't get counted.
Right.
If you can keep it covered up undercover, it's never going to end.
And we do have multiple entries on, you know, police murders. You know, for example, there was a black soldier murdered in 1942 in Little Rock by police officers. You know, that shows definite continuity with, you know, what has traditionally been called lynching. So, yeah, we're covering, you know, these more modern police murders, too. And, you know, I do make the argument we need to expand our definition of lynching. I sort of end up in an odd situation where encyclopedias are often very conservative because they're based upon, you know, scholarly consensus right now. So, you know, for part of my work, I'm adopting, you know, a different sort of framework than, whereas in my scholarship, I'm trying to expand, you know, our frameworks, you know, and take a larger perspective. You know, it's, I have, you know, my day job is based a little more on consensus, and, you know, my freelance writing, I can, you know, work to change that consensus some.
Yes, I think that's critical because, you know, the yin and the yang is, I guess I can't really say that, but the goal is an accurate count of yin and yang. But the problem is every time we count, then, you know, a white person in general is accused of killing someone that they may or may not be held accountable or have not been held accountable for.
Right.
I think that's why there is a bit of reluctance and a narrowing of the definition.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate your time. And I'm sorry?
Oh, just sounded like you got your last question in?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Much obliged. I think we finally were able to get through all the folks who dialed in with their questions. Much obliged for your patience, Mr. Lancaster. Arkansas, we spent all that time on the Little Rock Five, and I felt like we still didn't really get into more details about the Elaine massacre of 1919. So hopefully you've written so much material, and just the archives alone would be interesting to go through. Maybe folks will have some time to kind of go through the online encyclopedia of Arkansas so they can check out some of these documents. He said 200 separate incidents of lynchings that are online. Folks can go and check out, get some information. Maybe they'll have some questions so we can have you back to go over more details, since folks seem to be piqued by the conversation. But the book we've been discussing that just came out most recently, American Atrocity, folks can check it out online or go to the libraries. They should be back open. Check out, we read some of the snippets from information this evening. If you are a victim of racism, especially if you're classified as black and you reside in Arkansas, have family in Arkansas, you should check out this book. Talk about that all the time. You should know. And if that's the case, the latter, in terms of if you have some sort of connection to that geographic location, you should definitely go to online Encyclopedia of Arkansas and do some study. And maybe you check out one of those 200, one a week, you know, as you have a free moment. But thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Monday evening with us, Mr. Lancaster. It has been a hoot going through the book and getting some information. I feel like I know a lot more about Arkansas than I did before. One of the few states that I have never visited specifically. But thank you for the book, and thank you for sharing some of your time and insight, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. And if ever you do make it down this way, just let me know.
Will do. Near the hot springs. I had thought about it. That would be a reason to go to Arkansas, go visit the hot spring. We could see the Confederate soldier. He wrote about that as well. I was reading that article today. Much obliged, Mr. Guy Lancaster. Thank you for your time. We will talk to you soon, sir.
Okay, thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you, sir. Wow. Context of white supremacy. I don't know if we have listeners in the Arkansas area or not. I'm not familiar with that area, like, at all. Little Rock 9, Bill Clinton, the base he got in trouble for. Or not got in trouble for, where he was accused of flying Mensa, I think that's it. Mensa, Arkansas?
Mina,
that's it. I was close. Got the wrong M word there. We'll check in. Any of our listeners who are with us, any thoughts, what they heard from the broadcast this this evening? Anything they wanted to make sure they share before we wrap things up? Much obliged for folks who dialed in. Hope it was worthy of your Monday evening. We'll say again, it is always helpful, folks, when they do not wait until the last 30 seconds or so to dial in. Like, always better get a hand up. Don't be a spectator. It shouldn't take 90 minutes to get warmed up for your question either. Go ahead, get your hand up. It's just much easier to navigate as opposed to getting 90 minutes in and then, oh my goodness, everyone has a hand up now. Much obliged. Any folks with thoughts that they want to share, what they heard?
Can I be heard?
Our caller, I think this is our caller in California, I believe.
Yeah, my apologies for the raising my hand very late. But I noticed when he was answering my question, he used a phenomenal race code word or racist word, however you want to frame it. But he said dark energy in regards to the like pint up white energy that they're going to use to harm people. He called that dark energy. I thought that was incredible.
That idiot talks about metaphors like once a week, I think, on the compensatory call-in. Like, metaphors are very important, words in general, but metaphors. Yes, I wrote that down as well. In fact, I wrote it down and I misspelled it, and I was looking at my notes. I think I had like a G or something, or I left the G and the Y off. That's what it was. I left the G and the Y off, and it was like a D there or something. I was like, what? What is that? I was like, oh, dark energy. That's right. That's right. I had to go back and correct it. But yeah, I highlighted that as well. Metaphors. Other thoughts? Folks wanted to make sure that they get in.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for the guest. I did notice that he has a very extensive vocabulary, and I think he was using it to obfuscate. Well, I think he was purposely using it, that's why I'm bringing it up, to redirect questions from him. And I noticed he would, when he was asked a direct question, he would answer it by either quoting a black person. Or in my case, when I was asking him a question about himself, he wanted to talk about Dave. He was surprisingly honest, I feel, but not surprisingly deceptive. I mean, my lie.
Fascinating.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to say really quick, Mo in Dallas, I thought that was so important with your question where he pivoted to Dave's treatment, because I thought you were, I didn't think your question was confusing. I didn't think it was convoluted in any way. I grat what you said. You know, when Big Dave came in, hey, you be polite to this guy, you know, he's a good dude, be courteous to him, or, you know, and all that. And you said, well, hey, wait a minute, what was the difference in how you treated this guy that you were told by Big Dave to be polite to versus all the other black people? That was how I understood the question. I thought it was pretty clear. And I was like, oh,
yeah, man.
See, like, I'm waiting to see, like, yeah, let's see.
With a doctorate.
Let's see, you know. Let's see how he explains. And he got off talking about Dave. That was why I interrupted, because I know folks who listen to the cows, like, I really work not to do that. Like, when you all are asking questions, I don't interrupt. People don't interrupt me when I'm asking questions. Like, you know, saying that was like, wait a minute. Like, we are going up buckets of work. I could have done the sound clip too. Like, wait a minute, man, we are deviating. Like, let's get back to the question. Like, well, for that type of thing, you have to watch that when talking to individuals classified as white. I'm concluding that that is deliberate racism every time. That's just another form. Master deceivers, it can take a lot of different forms. Sometimes it's just not using correct words. We're talking about lynching and what have you, to call that prejudice or bias or discrimination. Other times, you can ask a simple question like that. How did you treat this Negro versus the other Negroes? And we get off on something totally different. I would even say, when you're talking to someone who has identified, you ask and they say, yes, I am classified as a white person. And then you're talking about racism, white supremacy, and they talk about white people saying they. It should be we, us. I'm included, not special, separate from the rest of the individuals classified as white. We, us. That's something to be mindful of as well. Our caller in Michigan, thank you for your patience. Did you have commentary?
I did, just quickly. You know, I enjoyed this, listening to him. And he's, you know, very knowledgeable and very enthusiastic about his work. But I don't see anything he's doing that's going to ever solve this problem. You know, he's semi-documenting it, but not really digging in. You know, I can't remember how he worded it, but apparently they have rules of how they define lynching, which, you know, if you wrote the rule, you can change it, right? You know, and so what? So it just seems to me it's another way to minimize, you know, the evil that this particular group of people have done over all these years. But on the other hand, he's pretending kind of to address it. He's, you know, he's willing to talk about it, but I didn't hear any solutions. So that's my commentary.
I think that was where I said dedication. White people are dedicated to racism, white supremacy. If anything, that should just be made clear. Don't know what to do about it. They are dedicated. Man, not going to turn loose to it. Just saying that would be helpful. That way we have a better assessment of the problem. Incidentally, our caller in Michigan, she was saying the numbers, which are staggering, like 4,000 people. Approximately 5,000 people outside for a lint like that is, geez, like I've been through towns that are not that large. That's staggering.
And that's not all of them. That's that limited definition, right?
You know, and that's not even the largest. Like I've heard events in Mississippi where it was approaching 10,000 people, where they got to advance, you know, put it in the newspapers and what have you, and send out telegrams that it's going to happen so people could catch the train and all the rest of it and make a big to-do about it. Like, that is staggering. And I was bringing that because in Michigan, they have the same history. They, during World War II, no less. Now, I mean, that's, we talk about veterans and all that, like total disgrace. So during World War II in Michigan, they have all the Ford factories and everything. So they're cranking out material for the war. And so, all hands on deck, right? They bring in like 6 black females, we'll say. It wasn't, you know, dozens. It was like 6. Let's say 10. They bring in 10 black females. The white women were out. It was the same thing. You had a protest of like thousands of white women in Michigan during World War II because you hired these nigger women. You're going to let them use the bathroom? That was a big brawl. You're going to let these Negro women use the same bathroom as in Michigan? That's why I say learn your local history. If you live in the Arkansas area, you should check out those, the online Encyclopedia of Arkansas. Check out those lynchings and whatever else. I mean, who knows? You know what they got cataloged? I think he said it was like 6,500 entries or what have you. See what they got online if you live there. Local history is rife with white supremacy racism. And like I said, in Michigan, it was thousands of them went out to protest. They hired like 10 black females.
Right. And we live in the north, so-called north, right?
That was in...
So we border Canada. It doesn't matter. I think it's nationwide, worldwide problem.
That was in James Lowen's Sundown Towns. There were more sundown towns in the north. He mentions Michigan repeatedly, talking about they only allowed black people to migrate to very select locations in Michigan, like Detroit, Dearborn, like a very few number of spots. They're just not all over. Flint, you know, they're in a very few locations. Once you get outside of those areas, no black people there, might be consequences. Might find some of those signs, no Negroes allowed. Incidentally, that's always one of my go-tos. Like I read from James Lowen the part about the police, which I think is great. I highlighted that when we read it, that it's not that white people were ignorant about police terrorism. It's exactly what Mr. Lowen said. They expected and applauded police abuse of black people. That is more accurate to what we have. Not, we didn't even know that. Yes, we did. Rodney King was a long time ago. They had better be Rodney Kinging them black people out there. That had better be happening. That's what we pay them for. But also in James Lowen's sundown town, he talked about those billboards, man. I bring that up all the time. Like, at what point, when there are billboards that say, no Negroes, what if he said, read Negra, if you can't read, run. Remember that one? It was tons of those. So when you have these billboards up, what white people are ignorant about? What white person sees that sign and says, no Negras? What does that mean? Hey, Billy, have you seen the billboard? What is that? What is this Negra thing about? What does all that mean? What white person sees this billboard and that's their response? Even the white, in fact, James Lowen said the children were the enforcers. Remember that he had the anecdotes where they would go? They had nigger shooters, not slingshots. they were called nigger shooters, where they would go if they saw a black person. Could be Mr. Carter who was lynched or anybody else. They come stumbling in town or walking through. What are you doing here? No niggers. Chase them right out of town. He said this was the 5-, 6-, 7-year-olds who went and did this. We got that repeatedly. In Forsyth, Georgia, it was the same thing. It was the children. They went and delivered the notice to the house. Niggers, you have 24 hours to vacate. Remember, I said it's been 260 of these events at minimum. Purges of black people. The children. That's what I mean. We talk about white people being ignorant. And he did bring that up a lot. I said that during the program while he was here. That is suspicious. That's what I would expect someone who is committed to white supremacy racism to do. To insist white people are ignorant about racism. Didn't Bill Clinton write the crime bill? And then have the, my bad. I guess I shouldn't have done that, maybe. That is not ignorance. You can't sit in the White House for 8 years. I said that about President Obama. Like, I bet he learned a lot about racism, white supremacy. You cannot sit in the White House for 8 years and be ignorant and or fail to comprehend what racism, white supremacy is. You can't even be the governor of Arkansas for 4 years and fail to understand what racism, white supremacy is. Like, all of that is super suspect. And it's so consistent, white people insisting they are ignorant about racism. Incidentally, he was lengthy in his responses. I could have used the buckets and buckets of words, but some of those anecdotes, like when he was talking about his family members, saying his grandfather participated in putting down the union strike and their responses to some of the other events that took place. When he gave the anecdote about the white woman finding the finger, he said it boggles to mind. He said it boggles the mind to imagine that her white father didn't know that this finger was here and what this was, you know, what this was attached to, why his father, her granddad, why he had this to begin with. Not ignorant, not shame either, because, I mean, hey, a finger. Who is going to find the finger other than Jeffrey Dahmer? And, oh, yes, we need to keep this for any reason other than this is going in the trash, like we got the Rona and all kinds of things. Why do I need a mummified Negro finger in my attic? why would I keep this? Let's throw this away. If I'm not going to actually try to find the relatives or what have you, give it to someone, yeah, maybe they can match or whatever. If I'm not doing that, in the trash. No, I'm going to keep this. And got the newspaper clipping with, like, are you serious? I said that consistently. I wrote about it. It's so many white people. They have reports on NPR. Ignorance about, they don't need Tim Wise's book. They don't need Mr. Lancaster's book. They can go talk to their grandparents, aunts, uncles, go look through their attic and find, oh, they have a report on NPR. White woman, she said she went, her grandfather had the same thing, some keepsake from where they lynched a Negro out in the Midwest somewhere. He kept this and they passed this down like decades. Like, it's tons of that. Even some did whole films. The documentary on ESPN, Ghosts of Ole Miss, they were showing when white people terrorized James Meredith. An entire school terrorized one black person. The legend, James Meredith. I have so much respect for him. But within that, they had a riot on campus, killed a white person. The filmmaker, who is white, went to Ole Miss. He's looking at the photographs, and he says, oh, man, that looks like Uncle Ted. He goes and is so certain, like, dang, I think that's Uncle Ted in the crowd yelling at James Meredith. He goes and asks his, I think he said his aunt or whoever, older relative, like, is that Uncle Ted? And they say, oh, get out of here. That's not Uncle Ted. He said, but the ages match up and we're here. Like, are you sure that's not Uncle Ted? He's like, get out of here. That's not Uncle Ted. No, do such a thing. Acting like he went and tried to terrorize James Meredith.
You know, that is really creepy what they do with these body parts. Because I recall when the Nat Turner movie came out, some white family returned some of his body parts to his descendants. And so, you know, but they never explain it. Why would you keep this stuff? What were you, I have read stories that they, you know, kind of ate some of the bodies and, or made lampshades out of skin and stuff, but I don't understand it. But they never explain, you know, it's not because you're hungry, right? So, What are you really doing? Why would you keep, you know, body parts? Preserve them? I don't know. I would not be able to sleep with a body part in the house. So, mysteries of that other culture. I guess it's going to be preserved for a while. Maybe one of them's probably written a book about it. And because like this gentleman, you know, he was very enthusiastic and very happy about his work. So I'm sure somewhere. But you're good at finding stuff like that. Delectable, so you'll get the book for us to read one.
That's one, Delectable Negro, by Vincent Woodard, the late Vincent Woodard. But that's what that book is all about. It has a whole chapter on Nat Turner and the cannibalizing his body and how they made it into different oil and what have you that they talked about that was ingested and bragged about, lampshades. He has a whole chapter just on Nat Turner and other parts where this comes up repeatedly in white culture. The Delectable Negro, that's in the book club, 2017 book club. So many plugs for the book club, my goodness. But Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro, and then Mummies, Cannibals, Vampires. That one's from 2012. That's not in the book club, but that is, we had the author as a guest on the program, and that deals with the same subject matter. But that's two right there. Vincent Woodard's book is awesome, though. I wrote that down because he has a passage in the book talking about this in American Atrocity, where he talks about the collecting of body parts. These are souvenirs. You know, you go to the lynching, then you got to get a little bit of the rope, or you get some of the teeth, or a finger, or a piece of skin, or a finger, or testicles, or whatever it is. Why would this be kept and on display in some cases? Like, it's not like that's why there's no shame. White people, I've seen no evidence that white people are ashamed of practicing racism, white supremacy. I have seen, might get in trouble for this. Better hide this. Again, if there was some shame, the finger would be in the incinerator. Let's burn this immediately. I don't see that. It's kept. it's where the keepsakes are. You got the photos from the wedding, the Negro finger, like.
Yeah, I'll never understand it. So.
Any other commentary before we wrap up? We should have a different white person here on Wednesday, June Blue Spruce. That's, I said she had a peculiar name this weekend, June Blue Spruce. I found her. I was in Green Lake. I love Green Lake. That is like my favorite area. I said that all the time. But they did a book club? Or I don't know. A Zoom session. We'll call it a Zoom session. So she co-wrote this book. They're talking about racism from the white perspective to other white people who live in Green Lake and have a beautiful life. And so they did like a 2-week Zoom session on this book that just wrapped up this past weekend. So she'll be on the program Wednesday, and I believe her editor. So we'll have like two white. So for sure, that means Wednesday, like no spectating and horsing around like 90 minutes and then waiting to put my hand up like we have two individuals classified as white on the program. But we'll get to hear like what they talked about. Maybe they'll talk about how cool Green Lake is if they live in that area. But that should be Wednesday. Two white, even though I generally do not like having multiple guests on the program. That's topic for another day, baby. But always enjoy having individuals classified as white on the program. That is the problem. That's who we should be questioning. Anybody else? Comments they want to get in?
Yeah, Gus. I have a suggestion for a future white guest. She is the author of the book Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race by Shauna H. Swan. And do you think you will have Lancaster back on in sometime in the future?
I believe, unless my memory's bad, I believe I invited her a while back and I didn't hear back. That's like a relatively new book. I think I just heard of it earlier this year about the fertility rates. And we've been talking about that quite a bit this year, even somewhat today, white genetic annihilation. But yeah, I can try again. That is important sometimes because I think I already have that book. By double check, I'll have to look on my computer to see if we're thinking about the same book. I'd be down. I'm always down to, you know, white guests only. I would certainly be down to have him back on the program. I was serious about the Elaine massacre, just going into more detail about that. And I think they are having conversations about reparations around that. So to look at some of the information that he has and how that's, you know, if they're making any progress with that, as well as just going through some of those archives, like what, you know, what's in those 200 cases, like that might be worthwhile as well. So, yeah, possibly, yeah, once I get a little bit of time to look at the records, and if other folks ask some questions that they want to ask, if he's willing to come back and chat, like, yeah, I'd definitely be down to have him back on the program. Grant, was it one other person? Somebody else that had a quick question or comment they wanted to get in?
Yes. Yes. I'm unclear. Did he give a concise answer to the confusing question as to who's most confused? Because it was actually asked twice by you and the caller from Texas.
I thought, or at least when I asked, I guess Mo in Dallas can give his own response, but I thought when I asked him, he said that non-white people white people were more confused, and he said that he gave an example of like one of the lynchings that took place in Arkansas that I guess they were in some sort of project about this. They were talking about these events, and he said that the black people, they had heard some version of what took place with these lynchings, whereas many of the white people said that they didn't know. They hadn't heard anything about these events, so that was one way that he kind of explained taking that position that the non-white people were more confused. And I think at some point we said lying. White people do a lot of lying amongst many other reasons. But yeah, I think he said non-white people. That was at least my recollection. I have to go back to listen to the recording to double check. But I think he said non-white people, and that was part of the reasoning. Mo in Dallas, do you remember when you were asking him about this?
Yes, sir. Gus, you might have to double check because I think he said white people are more confused. And I thought he validated that with the fact that sometimes it's they're ignorant to their advantages, which help them be confused. And I think I worded it in such a way to where I asked if this confusion, did he believe it was legitimate, or if he thought they were practicing, some sort of way to lack of a better term, sidestep accountability. 51%, he said he believes that they are liars. But he still believes that they are more confused than us. So I'm confused. I think we're more confused. I mean, my line.
I remember that the system makes white people ignorant to the advantages that they have. Not power, but advantages. And if I misspoke, that was my fault because I did mean to say I thought he said that white people were more confused. If I misspoke and said non-white, that was my fault. But I thought that he answered saying that white people were more confused, which is, I think, what Mo and Dallas said as well. And in the two different ways. Epistemological ignorance, because he quoted Charles Mills. I said something about that before, the late Charles W. Mills. But yeah, that was when he threw that one in, the folks who were talking about vocabulary. I wrote that down to, I was going to ask him to lower his vocabulary level, but it was more of an issue, just the buckets of words that, you know, some of the responses were not related. We had to kind of prompt him about that and taking too long. But that was when I stopped asking, because we had Justice here for so long. She would ask like, hey, I'm 10, I'm 12. Lower your vocabulary level. But I used to ask that all the time. I had that right in my list. And folks, you all can do that too. Like, you know, lower your vocabulary level. We encourage children to listen to the program. And, you know, I haven't done a dissertation or what have you. So if you can make it a little easier for me to comprehend. Did we miss anybody? Everybody satisfied? Got it in. Be back Wednesday. So have more opportunities to question someone classified as white. That should be two white people.
One last question, Gus. The parallel between the videos of the police killings and the lynching. Who was the author of that article that we referenced often?
I used to say the great, but then we read Case, so now I don't say that anymore. Oh, and that's Cowbell, too. Now that we read Case, it's Cowbell. Isabel Wilkerson, but she did write that piece, which is like 2014. It was right after Michael Brown Jr. Was killed, and she made the compare. I'm sure many people have made that comparison, but that's just the one that I point to most frequently because that's one of the earlier ones that I saw. And she just talked about the numbers, even though it came to mind when we were speaking with Mr. Lancaster this evening, that the lynching postcards, they were not stopped out of shame or white people no longer being interested in viewing that sort of imagery. The post office stopped carrying them, right? So federal intervention, and even then it continued. Like, it took quite some effort to get that to stop, get white people to stop sharing images of dead black people. That notwithstanding, Isabel Wilkerson, I think it was a piece for The Guardian where she wrote this, and she talked about the images of like Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown Jr. or Eric Garner. Pick the person. You can even update it. Those images, George Floyd more recently, they get so much wider circulation, global circulation. People, whites all over the world, you know, can partake in that, which is, you know, dwarfs anything of those lynching postcards from the years gone by. So the refinement and reach of white supremacy racism has escalated drastically. But that's Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, which is phenomenal, well constructive as well. And then she also wrote Cased, second worst book ever. Cowbell. We'll be here on Wednesday. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The Warmth of Other Suns is in the book club. Both of those are the book club. Reading is more important than watching television. Cased is in the book club as well. Warmth of Other Suns. You can just go back and hit the book club for all of that and hear exactly why. Warmth of Other Suns is in my top 10, even though I give it the side eye now. Cased, second worst book ever. Ugh. Anywho, much obliged for folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your Monday evening. Sobriety would be best. Say that again. We had to say that a few times this evening. If you're going to be out and about, be alert. There are lots of violence. He said, we do not appreciate how much violence has been, remains a part of the system. When you're out and about, if someone is being rowdy and hostile, you should be thinking this fella or she may be armed. In fact, may have an entire entourage that is armed and ready to kill. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to die and or kill, exit. That is the word. All that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling. Super easy contribution to establishing justice. No gossiping. Moving in the right direction. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.